the main message. So the titles change a little bit. What the main description, though, is the goal is to find explicit time-dependent cosmologies in extra dimensions, and to with the motivation to addressing naturalness issues in general, using brains in extra dimensions as the tool. And in particular, the emphasis here is on back reaction from brains that are higher than codimension one. So if you think codimension is a number of dimensions transverse to your brain, Randall Sundrum kind of models where you have an end of the world brain would be codimension one examples of brains. And there you do solve the back reaction problem where you ask how the brain changes the geometry next to the brain. And I'd like to ask similar things about brains that have codimension two. And I'm thinking of them as being examples of higher codimension. And part of one of the messages here will be that codimension one, just as one dimension is very rarely representative of many dimensions, codimension one is very rarely, you shouldn't expect it to be representative of higher codimensions, whereas codimension two will be more representative, although it's still not completely representative. And so I'm going to be exploring what codimension two brain back reaction can do for cosmology in a variety of ways. So the way I'll set that up is I'll first do a quick motivation on extra-dimensional cosmology, and then I'll do a boilerplate reminder of what the naturalness issues are, because it's specifically technical naturalness I'm going to be interested in addressing, and I want to, it's often phrased in a variety of ways, and I want to make clear what my target is, but there's going to be no surprises there, I think. It's a kind of standard naturalness story. And then I'm going to describe an example, and many of you will know that my heart of hearts lives in six dimensions, and I think that's what they're going to find at the LHC. But this example, what you should think of is it's a toy model, and I'm going to present a paradox in that model. I'm going to be interested in the model has been chosen. I'm going to show you actually two models. And they're chosen to have a flat direction classically for some scalar field. And I'm interested in what the potential energy is for that flat direction once other effects like quantum effects or brain back reaction break the symmetry that made it flat. And we're interested to know what the shape of the potential is. And for cosmology, we're generally interested in very shallow potentials. And so the question will be, how shallow, what's the physics that governs these potentials? And there's a paradox because there's a general argument that tells you something about these potentials, which is what makes me love these six-dimensional models. But you'll see that the simplest, naive, dumb calculation you do to calculate this potential looks like it's in disagreement with this general argument. And the point of the next section, and the final section, will be to show you why there's no inconsistency, that the naive, dumb calculation is actually naive and dumb, and there's something which is being neglected in it. And once you do it carefully, you'll see that it agrees with the general argument. And I'll describe two examples, one of which will be essentially aimed at the cosmological constant problem, asking for maximally symmetric geometries, how big a curvature of De Sitter space or flat space or anti Sitter space would you expect as a function of the choices you make on a brain? And the second example will be a time-dependent example where you're looking at an inflationary or some evolving cosmology on the brain, and at the same time the extra dimensions are doing something too. And the story there will be you're interested in how the time-dependent properties. Whereas the first part is asking what the shape of the potential is, the second part will be asking how does the time dependence of the solutions driven by that potential respond to the choices you make on the brains. So motivationally, particularly for that last part, the time-dependent geometries in the extra dimensions, it's amazing how few examples there are of honest-to-God extra-dimensional cosmologies. Normally, when you find, there's string cosmology has been around for a long time, and in a very high-powered version in the last 10 years, and almost none of the stringy solutions that are talked about in string cosmology are actually honest-to-God solutions to the 10-dimensional field equations. Instead, what people typically do when they're talking about that kind of cosmology is they either work in a four-dimensional effective theory where they use the higher dimensional theory to identify some fields that will be scalars in the end of the day in four dimensions. And then when they're inferring how the geometry responds to the dynamics, they will use four-dimensional dynamics of scalars. And all they really needed the extra dimensions for was to motivate the four-dimensional theory in which the cosmology is done. But by doing that, you deny yourself access to many questions about what the extra dimensions are doing. The other kind of extra-dimensional cosmology that people talk about, which involves explicit solutions, tend to be static solutions in the extra dimensions, and you have mirage cosmology, where an observer will see a time-dependent geometry because it's moving through a static configuration like that. And I don't want to do either of those things. I'd like to have an honest-to-God extra-dimensional cosmology where the metric in the extra dimensions is changing. And one of the reasons I'd like to do that is that I'd like to ask, and one of the things inflation does, which is never emphasized because it does a lot of more interesting things, is it does give you very, very large four dimensions. And so one of the things you might imagine it doing is telling you about the relative sizes of the different dimensions that we don't see, that are not the four ones that were being blown out exponentially during inflation. And so you'd like to ask, how do those things evolve in time? Are they evolving faster or slower than the four dimensions that we see? And I'm going to show you an example where whenever the four dimensions are accelerating, the extra dimensions are going to be growing, but not as fast as the four dimensions were. And so that'll be interesting if you're trying to, in particle physics, you're interested in making choices about the extra dimensions. And almost certainly those choices are going to be understood ultimately in terms of where we were in the history of the universe. And this is a first step towards trying to understand that. For the naturalist story, there's essentially in cartoon form two things that you get from brain physics that is helpful for naturalists. One is, if you make the gravity scale small compared to the Planck scale, which is the ADD observation, or the small gravity scale where you're talking about probe range, you're not working about back reaction, you win a lot in naturalist arguments, because many naturalist arguments go along the lines of quantum corrections to something might have Planck scales in the denominator if you're only gravitationally coupled to things, but they typically will have then ultraviolet scales in the numerator, and if that's the Planck scale, that's an order one effect. If you make the scale of gravity small compared to the Planck scale, so say the string scale small compared to the Planck scale, then what happens is that the numerator part of that story changes, and you tend to saturate at a lower scale, and what was order one now becomes powers of the gravity scale divided by the Planck scale, or equivalently, inverse powers of the volume of the extra dimensions. And tracking those is really useful, because things that would have been generically large needn't be so large in this context. The Randall-Sundrum observation is that back reaction is equally important, that the warping, for instance, that you get from the presence of brains can be as important as that basic observation that the gravity scale is low when you're trying to understand the low energy limit of the theory. And so it behooves us to understand back reaction in these low gravity models. And there the thing that gives you pause is that the understanding of back reaction is mostly done in this codimension one context, and you have a sense that that's very likely to be representative of what's out there. And so part of the motivation for exploring codimension two is to explore the parameter space of these kinds of back reactions and to see if they help with naturalist issues, and I hope to argue that they do. So naturalists, here's the aside, the boilerplate aside on naturalness. The standard model, the hierarchy problem in the standard model is the way it's normally presented, so let me just start with that. So there you have the standard model. And the observation is that there's only one of the schematic constants in here. Okay. Only one of the constants in there has dimensions, which is essentially the thing that's going to turn into the Higgs mass. So from the point of view of scales, the standard model is a term plus a whole bunch of other things that are dimensionless. And the hierarchy issue is to do with the size of this parameter M, which is the one with dimensions. Now, one of the beauties of the standard model, it's ugly, but one of the beauties is it's the most general thing you can get given the particle content, and that underlines our belief that it's an effective theory for something that's more fundamental. And so the way you think about what the scale should be is driven by that picture that it's an effective theory. There's nothing special about the scale at which you're writing it down. We should be able to write down the standard model at any scale. And so if you imagine that the theory of the world has got lots of particle states in it between the weak scale down here and the Planck scale up here, we're writing the standard model down here, but we could imagine writing it down up here. And the naturalist issue is asking, how does that parameter in the Lagrangian change as you go through those various different scales? And in particular, if we're saying that the scale M naught, or the thing with dimensions in the Lagrangian, is smaller than other scales in the problem, how does our understanding of that smallness change as we ask the question at different scales? And so if you think about how that works, you know, this parameter M naught in the Lagrangian, ultimately we're fixing it from something, some experiment, and maybe it's the Higgs mass, or choose your favorite experiment, but there's a physical thing you're going to measure, which is the parameter you're interested in, plus corrections, loop corrections, say. And I can get it. And the corrections are important. That underlines the fact that this M naught is something, a proxy for something real, some real mass. Now, if you ask how the standard model would look if we wrote it down at some higher scale, where there's some other particles that we haven't discovered yet in this model, as well as the standard model degrees of freedom, you'd have a similar story. There'd be a parameter in its Lagrangian multiplying the Higgs term in the Lagrangian. And the physical thing, the honest-to-God Higgs mass, would be that parameter plus corrections. And some of these loop corrections that I didn't write here would involve these new particles that are in this new theory that were not in the standard model. And they, on dimensional grounds, typically go quadratically with the mass of that particle. And the way that the low-energy theory below that threshold brings the news of these heavy particles is that the parameter that we would see here in the low-energy theory is the one that we had in the high-energy theory plus the contributions of these loops that we'll never be able to do in the standard model because those particles are no longer there. They've been integrated out, and all their loop effects are buried in the parameters that are in the standard model. And then the hierarchy statement, the technically unnatural nature of the standard model is the statement that we believe that this scale is at the 10 to the minus is about 100 GeV, but because this is quadratic in all these masses, the loops generically are giving you quadratic things in masses. If you had a particle whose mass was 10 to the 11 GeV, you'd have to have a 20 decimal place cancellation between a large number here and a large number here to get a small number here, which is the thing that you're measuring at low energies. And so again, that's a logical possibility. No one can rule it out. But we have many, many hierarchies in nature that we understand. Most of them we understand extremely well, not just in particle physics, but in condensed matter physics, in astronomy, and biology. There's lots of hierarchies in nature. And the statement I would make about the technical naturalist criterion, which is the technical naturalist criterion is that if you have a small number, it's small no matter where you ask the question. That criterion is the way that all the hierarchies we understand work. And so it's a radical proposition to say that the hierarchy problem is not satisfied that way. That's, I think, the most conservative way to phrase things. It's a logical possibility, but it would be a major departure from the way nature has worked in the past.
So if I may miss your last point, so what are the ways it normally works?
The way it normally works, if you imagine taking an example, like supposing you're asking why are atoms large compared to nuclei or something, you could ask that in the theory of protons, electrons, and you know, neutrons, and then the answer would be, well, the fine structure constant small, the electrons light compared to the protons, say. But if you asked it above the QCD scale where there are no protons, you could ask it there, and there the answer is that the QCD scale is larger than the electron mass and the fine structure constant small. But no matter where you ask it, it has an answer. It's never that you, if the theory of the world was a standard model plus one heavy thing at 10 to 11 GeV, what would have to happen here is that if you ask why is this parameter M not small, the answer would be actually it's not really small. It's only small in the theory that you looked at. In this theory, it's enormous, and it cancels the 20 decimal places with this big contribution to give you something small. And that's could have happened, but it's never happened before, is the statement. And of course, it just gets worse the farther up you go because it's quadratic, it's sensitive to the positive powers of mass. And you notice I'm never saying cutoff here. It's often phrased as a quadratic divergence, but the one thing you know is not in your answer physically is a cutoff because it's something that's canceling some counterterm. And it's renormalized quantities that you want to follow in things, and it's renormalized masses that you'd like to follow, large logarithms and things. And so this way of phrasing it, if you like cutoffs, think of this as being a very conservative way of phrasing what the problem is. It's not a Planck scale problem. It's to do with particles you've removed in your theory. So now, the cosmologic constant problem. Well, that's one way out. So if there was nothing else, then there's no problem. But you know that something has to happen with gravity.
That's a different perspective. Sort of old school. So if you're a quadratic divergence kind of guy, you just wave your hands about it.
Yeah, I think if you push people, I'm giving you the old school story. But people tend to talk about cutoffs because they're really a proxy for some physics that they didn't follow. And what's nice about it is that you can phrase the cutoff in the effective theory without saying what the particles were that you didn't understand. But I think in the end of the day, everybody would agree that the cutoff is not in your answer. It's something which is canceling something else. If in the full theory you integrated down to some spot and stopped, and that was your cutoff, and then you did the rest of it, and then that's the thing that you're seeing in the low energy theory. But that arbitrary point of stopping wasn't in your answer. So asking it not to be there is kind of irrelevant because you knew that it wasn't there anyway. And so this way of phrasing it, you know, in the world where there were no new particles, you know that something has to happen because gravity is not in the problem, and so that you'd need to have a proposal for something which included those things and didn't have anything else. And so it's the absence of examples like that that drive the naturalness issue. And now, of course, the cosmologic constant is the place where you're really burned by that, because the whole naturalist phrasing in terms of masses in the standard model there was no problem with the naturalist problem there, but here, because anything you're going to do to fix the problem, like supersymmetry or compositeness or extra dimensions, which more or less are the three mutually exclusive ways of dealing with this issue, have to happen at the scales that are low, because...
What for the trees? Is the supersymmetry, the dimensions, and what is the third one?
Compositeness. So if the Higgs is built of something else, then its effective theory has no Higgs-Higgs term. So that would be one way to deal with it. Another way would be if your super partners are split by energies that are small, but they're all heavy, so that the cancellation, the bosons are canceling the fermions systematically, then again, you never had to have a large contribution as you integrate stuff out. And the extra dimensions just denies that there is anything above the weak scale. It just says it's all at low energy. And that's more or less the three options. That's why all the proposals fall into those categories, because they're driven by this question. But you see that you had a chance to use those issues, because you didn't really know what the hell was going on up there anyway. So you could make up something to fix it. So in particular, when we talk about the cosmological constant problem, people talk about the Planck scale being the problem. That's not the problem. You can fix it many ways at the Planck scale. The electron is the problem, the cosmological constant. Because if you do the same story for the cosmological constant, it's the other parameter with dimensions that you don't talk about in the standard model very often, but it's there. And the same thing goes through, but now let's do it for the standard model, because here's the cosmological constant scale, which is down at the neutrino masses, 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. Here's now the weak scale, and these are all particles we know are there. And now we ask the same question. So down here, there's a small value for the cosmological constant, which we're going to fit by agreeing with the observations in cosmology. So there's some physical measurement of mu, but there's also loop contributions and things that are contributing at low energies for these light particles. So we choose this number to be 10 to the minus 2 electron volts because that gives us the number we know we get when we measure things, which is 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. But if we ask the question above the electron mass, then this constant has to involve the constant. It comes from the constant that was in the effective theory at that scale plus the electron contribution, which is no longer around at low energies, and so it has to be stuck in there. And again, there's a cancellation that has to happen now to 32 decimal places. And so this way of phrasing it emphasizes that the problem is a low energy problem, and the problem with the cosmological constant problem is you're trying to screw with things where you thought you understood stuff. And you already have a problem there in the naturalist story. And that's why people despair, right? It's if you're going to fix so the good news is if you fix it, you're changing things at low energies where you have lots of ways of testing it. The bad news is it's really hard to screw with the electron in this to fix this and not screw up other things you know about the electron. And so any example that does that is good.
There's an assumption there that it's the coupling to gravity is the obvious naive thing, right? We make that argument.
It depends on exactly what you mean. I mean, you have to argue. I guess maybe the next slide will address that. I said this already. The next slide is this one. So the thing is, you have to address basically why the electron. We know that it's gravitating. We know how the electron gravitates at some level because we see objects gravitating. But we also know that quantum fluctuations of the electron also gravitate because graphs like this contribute to the binding energy of the rest mass of a hydrogen atom at the part in 10 to the 12 or something sees the Lamb shift. But we know that the equivalence principle works to a part in 10 to the 13. And so that we know that within an accuracy that should see quantum fluctuations, we really do see quantum fluctuations in the sense that this really is the total energy that's gravitating. And the mystery is, why is it when you erase these photons that tied this thing to the atom and you just look at the vacuum fluctuations, this seems to be zero and this is not zero? That makes it very stark, right? It's very hard to see why.
I'll bug you at the end or something.
Okay. To me, sorry.
What's the fruit? The fruit that I want to say we test this because.
Yeah, imagine if you ask the graph that would see the Lamb shift in the energy of the hydrogen atom. So you've got a graviton coming in, it sees an electron fluctuation, and then two photons come off to tie it to the atom in some way. So this graph, if you didn't have the graviton, this would be the graph that would give you the Lamb shift.
So, using graviton correction.
So now I want to see it gravitate. So I'm going to classically tie a graviton to it. And so then I'll ask for what the classical solution would be. And so graphically, this is the graph you're looking at. The graviton could attach to anywhere, but it's in particular attached mm-hmm. here.
You mean the question is, this is tested? This is experimental?
Well, I think there's a quantitative question as to exactly the precision with which this kind of thing is tested. And I think that's something which I don't know if that's been done carefully. But at the order of magnitude level, it's bigger than the bounds. The bounds of the equivalence principle are 1 part in 10 to the 13, and this is bigger than that. I think for the Lamb shift, it's just a little bit, it's like factor 10 bigger than that. But so then the question would be, what atom gives you the best bound? And
can you phrase this as a detection of the graviton?
Well, no, because you're not making a wave. You're not actually making a fluctuation in the field. It's just you're seeing the static coupling to the energy. Just like you would have done classically, so it's this. So to me, what's really convincing about extra dimensions as a solution to this is that it's the only example I can think of that does this. You know, there's not a lot of options on the table. And the reason that there's not a lot of options on the table is that this is really hard to do. But if you think about large dimensions, they do exactly this. The problem is, in essence, the cosmological constant problem is you've got a curvature, which is small, which you measure. You've got a Lorentz invariant vacuum energy, which you think should be large. And Einstein says they're the same. And then you're screwed. But if you have but you're only screwed in four dimensions. If you're in more than four dimensions, no one says you're a Lorentz invariant in more than the four dimensions. And so you can have curvature that you're not seeing. So it could be that the Lorentz invariant energy is sourcing curvature in the extra dimensions. And there are certainly solutions that do that. That doesn't solve the cosmological constant problem in itself, because what you have to ask is that if I've chosen things to make the geometry that we see in the large directions flat, are those choices stable under normalization? And the rest of the talk is aimed at that question.
If you do that, so you want to preserve Lorentz invariance in 4, would break it in 6, my next question is, haven't you just gotten a problem a lot worse than the cosmological problems? And why are all the things in the standard models, which I should really write in 6, why didn't all the parameters just double?
All the parameters just double.
Right, so I normally write down the standard model couplings by assuming that I have Lorentz invariance. So I've got symmetry.
Oh, you still do it in 4 dimensions.
But I should really do this. If it's a really 6-dimensional theory, I should really do this in 6. Right? And then if it'll look 4-dimensional, it'll look 4-dimensional or not, right?
So there's 2 ways to go there. So in the old days, what people would have done is what you're saying is they would have said that you have some geometry which might be, supposing that the vacuum was a product of a sphere across flat space or something, or some maximally symmetric space. So maybe you're not going to so assume it's flat. Then as long as you're looking at wavelengths that are long compared to the size of the sphere, then you won't know that the sphere is there. Things look four-dimensional, and that would be the usual Kluze-Klein story. Mm-hmm. And that would require the sphere to be very small, because we know that the 10 to minus 17 centimeters or more. So now so that wouldn't help you with the cosmological constant problem, because that's such a small scale that your energies, the Kluze-Klein energies, are huge compared to the cosmological constant. But the 1990s take on it would be that there's another way you could not see extra dimensions. That's if you have a brain and then the standard model is trapped on a brain. You can't trap gravity on the brain, so it sees the extra dimensions, but all the non-gravitational physics can be four-dimensional right up to higher scales. And that's kind of the loophole that you're threading here. You're saying that the reason that the electron is not being screwed up anywhere except for gravity is that it's on a surface which has a lower, different dimension. But only gravity sees that you're really in 6 dimensions, or however dimensions you have, right at the cosmological constant scale, which is extremely low. And that's kind of, it's remarkable that was even possible, right? And the reason that that's possible is that the tests you would have about to see the existence of the extra dimensions, if they only can use gravity, are very weak. And then phenomenologically, you're allowed to have dimensions that are that large. So it's an interesting way that nature could work.
Might tend to argue pulsar doesn't do that. Okay.
What's that?
Some of us might tend to argue pulsar bound delivery seem awfully strong if you're
I don't think that, we should talk about that. Because
okay.
I think there.
I don't want to distract you on general side issues, and I don't want to let you get your hand on.
For these large dimension things, pulsars wouldn't be an issue, but I think you'll see that where I'm going to go is I think that there's actually in the long distance limit, the theory of the world that this would point you towards is actually a scalar tensor theory on macroscopically large scales like galaxies or higher. So I think that there's actually pulsars are going to be really interesting for that, but I don't think that they're at a point where they constrain these models, but they don't rule them out. And so I'd love to hear your take on that, but but there's a long story there. All right, so that's the hoopla. What I want to do really is give you a concrete example now where the goal is to ask the cosmological constant problem in a specific setting. So I'll just make some choices that will give me a flat solution where there's lots of energy on the brains, but there's a flat solution, and then I'll ask if I perturb around. That's not sufficient for the cosmological constant problem. I have to then ask if I perturb around that, look at what quantum effects, renormalizations would do as they integrate out heavy particles. Does it change the conclusion that you're close to flat space? And I want to argue that I'm going to show you an example where the natural scale, regardless of what the scale of physics is on a brain in this situation, the scale of the cosmological constant is going to always want to be the Kluze-Klein scale, is the point of the next, almost all the rest of the slides. So I want to take this toy model as the example to show that, and I'm going to take 2 examples of it. So it's a Maxwell scalar Einstein theory in 6 dimensions. There's 2 parameters here, A and a potential energy for the scalar. And those are just really going to be choices I'm going to make as 2 examples, and I can show you all at one slide by sticking them in here. The non-supersymmetric example I'm going to choose does not couple the scalar to the Maxwell field, so A will be 0. And then it also has only a cosmological constant, and there's no actual potential for phi, and so this will just be a cosmological constant. That has a flat direction because there's a shift symmetry where the scalar field phi shifts, because now it only appears in the kinetic term. And in that example, I'll be interested to know how that particular flat direction gets lifted. The one I'm going to really show you that I'm going to be most interested in is the supergravity example. And this is one of the many supergravities in six dimensions. And this particular one has A equals 1. And there's a particular potential, which is given by an exponential of phi and some parameters that are just numbers in the theory. G sub r, kappa is Newton's constant, essentially, in the extra dimensions. And G sub r is a gauge coupling for a particular U1 in the supergravity. This also has a flat direction, which is less obvious. Classically, the flat direction is associated with the scale invariance that the supergravity Lagrangian has and higher dimensional supergravity Lagrangian generically have. What happens is if you shift phi by a constant and then you also shift the metric by a particular constant, then there's a choice for those constants where every term here scales the same way, is the upshot. And so that's not a symmetry in the sense that the Lagrangian is not invariant, but it's a symmetry of the classical equations, because if I take d action d phi equals 0, that's something which is being left invariant by that scaling. And that's essentially going to be underlying a lot of the magic I'm going to describe. But there's a flat direction associated with that, which corresponds to shifting phi, as well as shifting the metric. And so I'm going to be interested in that case and what stabilizes that flat direction. And that will be tied up with what stabilizes the size of the extra dimensions.
Are we mostly minus, or?
The signature of the metric, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to be mostly minus, but I'm not being, there should have been an overall minus sign for this whole thing.
OK, I was just usually there.
Well, there's also a curvature convention you have to also do, but I'm using Weinberg's curvature extensions and mostly minus, and I didn't put a sign in here deliberately just because.
These are conventional matter fields.
Yeah, there's nothing fancy going on. Yeah, it's positive energy. It's all positive potential, so it's yeah. There's no signs being hidden by the fact I'm not writing them all. Yeah. All right, so those are the two theories I can look at, and I can tell you much about both of them in one go by keeping that parameter A around. So the simplest solution, which is not the only solution that's known, many of the solutions for these theories are known, and all of the ones that are flat are known, I think, and four-dimensionally flat. But here's a A class of solutions which kind of illustrate the point. And they're basically, they have the form of the extra dimensions are a sphere, and so the L would be describing the radius of that sphere. The metric in the four dimensions is some maximally symmetric metric, de Sitter, anti de Sitter, or flat, and the question will be how big that curvature is for that metric. There's a Maxwell flux, which is threading the sphere like a monopole would have done if it had been sitting in the middle of the sphere. It has a Q is describing the strength of that flux. Alpha here is describing a defect angle. If I took a wedge out of the sphere along two lines of longitude and glued them together, then there's a conical singularity I'd grow at the two points at the north and south pole, and that's the back reaction of two brains. And it doesn't have to be true that codimension two brains give you only conical singularities, but it sometimes is true, and this is an example where it is. Say that again, sorry?
If the extra dimensions are a sphere, you take the sign here, and
yeah.
But that's essentially, when you say it could be open or closed, or...
The sign is always a sign. So the extra dimensions are always a sphere. And then the other thing is to do with what the four dimensions are doing. And so the G hat here could be de Sitter space or could be anti de Sitter space. Yeah. So the integration constants essentially are phi, which is a constant, L, which is the radius of the space, alpha, which is this defect angle, Q, which is the flux of the, you know, the size of the magnetic flux. And I've put a conventional factor of e to the minus a phi here just because this is, you know, this is not there. This is only there in the supersymmetric case where a is 1. And that's because scaling these factors, e to the phi, are making the burden of the scale transformation be carried only by phi. So everything else in that case is invariant under the scale symmetry that I talked about.
So if alpha is 0, you don't have a defect? Or
alpha if alpha is 1, there's no defect. So then that's the sphere. So the defect you'll see in a second is going to be alpha minus 1.
Sorry, one simple thing I'm obviously missing. The usual equation here is del squared phi equals e to the minus alpha f squared. Right? So how is that? Consistent.
With what? So you're asking why is how can phi equal constant satisfy box phi equals stuff?
Yeah.
There's two things in the stuff, basically, and one of them was the potential. So there's two cases. There's a non-supersymmetric case, where there was no potential energy and there was no coupling to the Maxwell field. So then it's just box phi equals zero, as easy. In the supersymmetric case, there's a Maxwell coupling, but there's also potential. And so box phi is equal to a potential plus the Maxwell term. And so one of the equations will be phi is a constant that those two terms have to balance. And that's going to give me, I'll show you the equation.
Okay, you're going to find it. Okay.
All right, so that's the ansatz. And there are a class of solutions that are known for this ansatz. So if you put the back reaction in, that relates the brain properties to this. It just tells you that this defect angle is related to the tension of the brains in the way that you all are expecting anyway. And now in the non-supersymmetric case, if you ask, what do the equations of motion say about these constants, then this is your question. Then, first let's do the non-supersymmetric case where we don't have the dilaton. The dilaton is, the scalar field is simple. It's just got a shift symmetry. In that case, the two equations that have content are really the Einstein equation is telling you the curvature of the two dimensions and the four dimensions. They say this. There's also a flux quantization condition for the flux threading the sphere. The physics of the reason the flux is there is that gravity would like to make the two dimensions implode. The flux resists that because of flux quantization. If you make the space smaller, the flux is fixed. So that means if the volume is getting smaller, the field strength has to get larger. That costs you energy, and that's what's fighting gravity, essentially. And so there's a stabilization that goes on of the extra dimensions because of that flux. And so this integer n can't be zero to make the whole thing work, as you'll see in a second. So what you can do here is you can solve these two equations for Q and for L. And then this just tells you what the curvature of the four dimensions are. And so that's what this tells you. So Q and L become these. And the free variable you get to dial here is alpha, the defect angle, which was tied to the tension of the brains you stuck in at the north and south pole. When you do that, the curvature is just this again. And so what people often do is choose the cosmological constant in the extra dimensions. They tune it to make the four dimensions flat. So we'll just tune lambda to be Q squared over 2. And then they ask, if I perturb around that, what happens? So let's do that. So you make lambda equals Q squared over 2. That makes R hat equals 0. If you now perturb the tension, then what that does is that perturbs the defect angle. And since you know how everything depends on the defect angle, these things are explicit formulas, you can just follow what happens. And you can ask, in particular, what happens to the curvature in the four dimensions? And if I get a curvature which is non-zero, how big is it compared to the change of tension that I stuck in? You know, did I win in the cosmological constant story? And the answer is no, you don't win. You change the tension by amount delta t. You linearize all those equations I showed you. You get a curvature r hat, which is, I'm writing in this way, it's some factors which are chosen because that's Newton's constant essentially in four dimensions, times rho, which is what you would have interpreted as being the vacuum energy in four dimensions that gave you that curvature. And rho in that convention just turns out to be twice the tension that you turned on. And that's exactly the right answer because you had a brain at both ends and they had to be the same to have the same defect angle. And so you've got exactly the curvature that the four-dimensional observer would have expected you to get. So the lesson here is that the non-supersymmetric extra dimensions do not help. And that's...
So R hat is the four curvature?
Or? Four-dimensional curvature, yeah, that's the thing on the brain.
And that's, this result is for when the extra dimensions are two. Is this one of the ones you expect to be, how much do you expect that to be true for more than two extra?
I think this is actually generic to most situations. It's hard to not get this. I think if you take a generic situation, and this is based on a small number of examples, but physically I'm thinking that unless there's a good reason for it, what will happen is that you'll find that the four-dimensional observer has to understand everything that's going on. And so if there was a reason why rho was the curvature was smaller than you would have expected from the four-dimensional point of view, there has to be some mechanism that the four-dimensional observer would know to understand that. And so... This is so the generic argument that so my intuition is that this is what will generically happen, not just in two dimensions. I think there's a technical the reason that people don't know in detail is that there's the technical issue that I'm going to get to in later slides with higher codimensions. The reason that people don't look at higher codimensions normally is that you're trying to relate the brain properties to the properties of the bulk geometry, say. And in codimension one, that's easy because all you essentially do is you evaluate the action at the solution and nothing's diverging. But the situation in codimension two and higher, it's generic that the fields diverge at the sources. If you think of the Coulomb solution, say in three dimensions, that's what happens. And so there's a part of the literature which says, well, that means we're using the wrong equations. But the Coulomb example shows you that that's not, you should expect that to happen. It just means that the matching issue, the way you relate the physics of the bulk to the physics of the brain is a little bit more subtle than it would have been in codimension one, but it can be done. And the way you do it is you think about a nucleus. If you want the far field limit of a Coulomb field from the nucleus, you don't care what the quarks are doing. You just care about the first few multipole moments. And so The issue here is you want to identify the analog of the first few multipole moments gravitationally that are sufficient to tell you what's going on for the rest of the large distance gravity. And so the technical story behind the story is that one, and I'll allude to it a little bit later, but that's basically what's going on.
So again, my question, was R time dependent or
static? This was assumed to be maximally symmetric, so this in this particular case, I wouldn't have seen any time dependence. All right, so how does that change in the supersymmetric case? So this is the one that I'm going to make a case that it actually does better than the non-supersymmetric case. So here's just a reminder, this is the same action, but now I've chosen A equals 1. Here's the same field strength. Here's the same phi. Now, the field equations tell you the curvatures, the two metric equations are these two. And the new equation is the dilaton equation, which is what your question was about. I'm not sure why that's doing that, but this is the condition that the potential energy, which has got this g squared in it, is balancing the flux, essentially. And that's why you're allowed to have a constant solution. There's more than just a solution known. If you have unequal tensions, for instance, the solution's also known there. And in that case, the dilaton is not a constant. There's a profile, and there's also warping in the geometry. And so there's a broader class of solutions that are known. These are just particularly simple because they don't have warping going on. Flux quantization is this condition. This is what it turns out to be in this case. It starts off being the same, but because we know in this, the main thing that's different in this situation compared to the previous one is that Q and L are dictated in terms of parameters in the Lagrangian, G and kappa, and don't care about the defect angle. And so that means that they're not variables that are changing as you adjust the tension. They're just fixed by the equations of motion. And the only place the defect angle enters is in the flux quantization condition. The surprising thing is that for all values of the parameters, the on-brain geometry has to be flat. And this back in the 80s was why people remarked on this system as being unusual. That's the Salam-Sezgin observation in the early 80s. So because it's always flat, that's the thing that gives a hint that it should be a result that's robust against changes to things. And that's what I'd like to ask now. I want to repeat the same calculation we did for the non-supersymmetric case and ask, did we buy anything?
So is this the same reason that, I mean, in any supersymmetric theory, you just have the vacuum energy contribution can be zero? I mean, why is this any different?
This is different in the sense that that as soon as I have a brain, so if we really took the Salam-Sezgin solution where alpha was 1 and there were no brains, then that this is the answer that they gave you in the 80s, that they would said that the mystery is solved. In that special case that there's no brain, and that you've chosen one unit of magnetic flux, so the integer n was 1 or minus 1. In that case, one of the six-dimensional supersymmetries is unbroken by the geometry. And so then they said, well, it's not a surprise that we find that it's flat. And that was the answer that they would have said in the 80s. What happened in the about 10 years ago was people realized that made it sound like if I had given you a monopole flux 2 or 3 or something like that, then that argument would have failed because that's no longer supersymmetric. But those solutions are now known too, and they're also flat. And what's happening in that case is that the four-dimensional, so Salam and Sezgin were right that the four-dimensional components of the six-dimensional Einstein tensor or Riemann tensor are not zero. But it's because the geometry is warping. The induced metric is flat. And the warping is giving you components to the the Riemann tensor which are non-zero in the four-dimensional direction. But that doesn't mean that the observer on the brain would see a curved geometry. It just means that there's warping going on as you move around the extra dimension. So supersymmetry is not explaining that example. And also, if you turn these tensions on where alpha is not 1, then those are also breaking supersymmetry, and so this is still 0. So it's a much more robust than supersymmetry would have led you to believe. But the problem is, if I want to do the same dumb calculation I just described here, the basic problem is if I change the tension, I change the defect angle, and then I'm screwed because the defect angle is not allowed to change because the flux quantization nails it to this integer, n, and I can't change that because that's an integer. It can't change continuously. So that's where people stop. I mean, people kind of got that far and said, well, what that probably means, people would have said, is that you can't find a solution in this class which is maximally symmetric. There must be some time dependence going on, and so then we don't know what that solution is, so we throw up our hands. But there's probably no miracles, is what people's intuition is based on the non-supersymmetric case. Now, there's a general argument, on the other hand, two general arguments, that say that there should be some magic going on here. The one general argument is that the general solutions are known for which the dilaton has a zero derivative as it approaches the brain, so that phi prime, their d phi dr, is it vanishing as you approach the brain. And those solutions are all known and they're all flat. That's the first observation. Second observation is that there's also a very general argument that says that you can integrating out the bulk fields corresponds an exact statement about integrating out the bulk fields at the classical level is what you're supposed to do is take all the massive Plouffe decline modes, solve their equations of motion as functions of the light modes, and plug that back into the action, and that will be the result of doing a classical integrating out of the heavy fields. It happens that in a supergravity case, the scale invariance of the problem allows you to do that for free, for an arbitrary solution. If you take the bulk action, the supergravity action that I showed you, and you evaluate it at any solution, it's always equal to the integral of box phi, it turns out. The equations of motion, you know, the thing in the action was curvature, Maxwell, and e to the phi, and those are all the thing in the field equation, and if you play with them a little bit, you see that that's a combination which corresponds to box phi. So now if you imagine excising a little region around the brain, source brains, this is a boundary term, which is the radial derivative of phi, and there's a matching condition, which is the analog of the Israel junction conditions, which is what I was alluding to, is the thing that relates the properties of the bulk field to the properties of the brain, and I'm going to say more about this later, is essentially a relationship between the asymptotic form of the derivatives of phi and the brain. So if you imagine thinking of the multipole expansion, the monopole controls the 1 over r term, the dipole is 1 over r squared term, you could pick those things off by picking off the most singular and the successively more singular terms as r becomes small. And there's a similar statement for gravity. And the upshot, which I'll say more about in more detail about later on, but it says that the radial derivative of phi is actually proportional to the derivative of the brain action with respect to phi. So this expression, which is a very general expression, says that if you should ever find an action which is independent of phi, then that would be a solution, that would give rise to a bulk solution for which the radial derivative of phi wants to be zero as it approaches the brain. This says that the vacuum energy for all those solutions should be zero, and we can check that because we know all of those solutions. All the solutions for which the radial derivative of phi vanishes near a brain are known explicitly, and they're all flat. So this general argument captures that fact, but it'd be nice to understand perturbatively if I start with one solution and I move to another solution, how do I see that they're related to each other? And the next slides are going to show you how that works, that there's a mistake being made in this calculation, which, when you fix it, gives you this calculation. So that's what the next few slides will say.
Can I just ask, is your perspective here is the deficit angle, is this an honest deficit angle, or just an approximation because we're working at scales that are large compared to some physics which just goes on with small scales?
What's an honest deficit angle?
I mean that, honest to God, no matter how small you zoom, you would actually see a deficit angle.
Oh, no, I don't mean that. I mean that
okay. There's
something going on, and I don't care. It's smaller than that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And so I'm imagining that this brain physics is something which is I'm capturing the gross features of something, and I'm not committed to what that thing is.
Okay,
it might be a deficit.
The bigger picture is that's really smoothed out if you got to some
small
scales, and somehow what we're doing is that scale's big enough that doesn't matter for what we're calculating.
Yeah, it needn't be, but it could be. So there's nothing you could certainly smooth it out, but if you didn't want to smooth it out, I wouldn't force you to. It's just something which, as long as I get to talk about the macroscopic properties, okay, I'm happy. Okay, so what's the resolution of the issue? What's basically going on in these systems, if you think about it, is that you change the tension. In a non-supersymmetric case, you change the tension. What happens is that the deficit angle changes, the volume changes, and so then the flux responds to that because the flux is quantized, so the field strength gets larger, and that's essentially the energy cost that you're looking at when you did the calculation in the non-supersymmetric case. It's expensive because the flux is homogeneous, and so the energy cost is proportional to the volume of the extra dimensions. In this case, what's happening is that the system is very rigid because the flux is being fixed by alpha. You're not allowed, because the field strength was fixed by the equations of motion and wasn't allowed to adjust, you had no way of compensating for the change of volume, and the flux quantization was too stiff for that. And so the resolution is that essentially what's going on is that the tension is a big thing which is dropping out of the curvature. And so to see what's going on in the curvature, you have to work at the subdominant order, but you have to include everything at that order to see what's going on. And what's going on here is that we're working to subdominant order in the bulk, but we're not working to the same subdominant order in the brain. So I'm going to just do a slight modification of the brain action. The brain action in general was a derivative expansion. In addition to the tension, there were also things with derivatives, and you might have thought the next term would be things with two derivatives, but it turns out there's something with one derivative that you can write down for these geometries. The Maxwell field is a two-form. In six dimensions, that dualizes to a four-form, and I can integrate that on the volume of some four-dimensional surface. So I can write down something like this as a term in the action, and it has a coefficient, which in principle could depend on the scalar field phi. And if you ask, what's the physical interpretation of this thing? The way to see what's going on is if you look at the boundary conditions for the Maxwell field and ask, how does the flux quantization condition change in the presence of a term like this? It changes in this way. You have the integer is equal to what it was before, the thing that's an integral over the bulk flux, but now you acquire a new term coming from the brains, which is proportional to this thing. And that shows you that what this is describing physically is flux that's localized on the brain. We could have done the same thing in four dimensions if we talked about a cosmic string. In cosmic string, the Maxwell field, I can write down a magnetic coupling like this of a Maxwell field to the world sheet of a cosmic string, and then you wouldn't have been surprised to hear that there's flux localized in a cosmic string, and that's what this would be describing. But the importance of it is that because it's allowing you to, it's giving you a way in which flux can relax, consistent with the flux quantization condition, in a not expensive way, because it's not going into a flux that's scaling with the volume, it's going into a localized flux which doesn't care about how big the volume is. And so it's going to be less expensive than it would have been as it was in the supersymmetric case. So the next slides are going to show you that if I track this thing through all those equations, I get the answer that the general argument would have told you should be the answer. So here's the calculation. So here's our, I'm going to look at, since I'm looking at perturbations now, I have to look at that slightly more general ansatz than I had been looking at before. So I'm going to look at the most general axially symmetric ansatz around these two brains that are in the extra dimensions. But I'm going to keep a maximally symmetric metric on the brains. So I have a warp factor now. I have a more general function here. I've got some sort of a Maxwell field, and I've got a profile for the dilaton. And I'm going to ask now how it responds to changes in the tension. So I'm going to take a small change in tension like I did in the non-supersymmetric case. Now, I've kept, in general, what will happen is if I take some change in tensions, I'm going to get I'm not going to have a static solution. And that's not so surprised. If we had done the same thing for electromagnetism and I gave you some random association of charges, and then that was static, and I perturbed them in some random way, then they'd start to move because they'd feel forces. So the generic situation is that if you start changing tensions and things, the extra dimensions will want to do something dynamical. But I don't really care if for small changes in tensions there was a flat direction, things are going to want to run down that flat direction because that's got the less cost and energy. Right now, I don't care how fast things roll. I want to know what the shape of the potential is that's driving you down that flat direction. So the way I'll explore that will be I'll turn on a current. In the non-supersymmetric case, I'll turn this one on. But in the supersymmetric case, I can turn this one on because this sees the root g of the metric. Just all I need is some current which sees that flat direction. And then I can choose a current to make any particular value of phi along that flat direction be a solution that's static in the presence of this delta t. And so this j will be a function of delta t, and the real solution will be the one corresponding to j equals 0. That's how I'll find out what the honest-to-God solution would have been if there had been a static solution. But there may not be a solution to j equals 0, and that just tells me I've got a runaway, and I'll have to deal with that. I'm going to linearize the equations, and the small thing that's being linearized is basically kappa squared j l squared, which is dimensionless. L, you remember, is the size of the extra dimensions. Long story short, you can linearize the equations. And the point of linearizing the equations is that you can get the general solution. And so you can find all the directions in field space. And so I'm showing you just two here just so you know that we're serious people. I should have said at the very beginning, the serious people, the guy who's serious here is Leo Van Nierop. He's a student who's graduating this year, and he solved this problem. He's a very sharp guy. Keep your eye on him because he's going to go places. So Leo found these solutions and more. And this is what the warp factor does. This is what the dilaton does. And there's other ones that are more complicated. The second reason for showing you these solutions is to show you that they diverge at the positions of the brain. I've chosen coordinates where r equals 0 is one of the brains. You see there's a log of r here. There's another log of r in here. And that's the generic situation in higher codimension. That's what makes it subtle to make the connection between these solutions and the brains if you're not in codimension 1. So you have to match those things to the brain properties. And so this is the solution to the matching problem. If you take the bulk fields, you take the derivatives in the direction, the radial direction near the brain, then you take it in the at very close to the brain. That's always proportional to a derivative of the action or a combination of derivatives of the brain action with respect to some bulk field. These are the analogs of the Israel junction conditions generalized to codimension 2. This quantity is kind of self-explanatory. This quantity u is something you don't normally follow. You don't normally follow the brain action as a function of the angular metric, and you don't need to follow it. The main thing is that these equations have a consistency condition, which is to do with the fact that this side of the equations, if you imagine integrating the field equations in the radial direction, there's a Hamiltonian constraint going on. And so that constraint means that this side of the equation is also not independent. There's a quadratic relationship amongst these things, which is identically zero. And this is what it turns out to be. So if you want to solve these boundary conditions, what you do in practice is that you choose the tension and this flux as a function of phi. And then whenever you need to know u, you solve the constraint for u. And the interesting thing about this constraint is that if the Lagrangian does not depend on phi, so that's 0, a solution is u equals 0. And so that's going to be important later on when you look at the curvature. The curvature, at the end of the day, is going to involve u. And so that's the thing that wants to vanish when the brains do not couple to phi. So if I use those boundary conditions and I take the solutions I told you, and I ask, what's the effect of a potential in the flat direction? This is what the answer turns out to be. If you solve for r hat of phi using the six-dimensional field equations, then if I do this integral, this is the potential that I would have had in the four-dimensional theory, which would match, would properly reproduce the dynamics of the six-dimensional theory using that matching. If I ask when is its what's its minimum, what's the when its derivative zero? I'm specializing here to the non-supersymmetric case. Then what you find is that the condition for the minimum is that if I take all attention, all the brains, I take this combination and I think of it as a function of phi and I extremize it. And this is actually what you would have expected to see. This is just the Lagrangian. That's the tension piece and this is that flux piece and this is what you would have had if I added them together to get the Lagrangian that we're talking about. So this just says you take the Lagrangian for all the different brains, add them up, minimize them and thinking of them as a potential, and that tells you the value of phi that the theory would like to have. So you can make the brains fight each other by not having the same minimum if you like, but you don't need to. This is the condition that this is what stabilizes, in that case, the flat direction. The energy at that minimum for this potential is this, and the interesting thing here is the 2. If we had just had a 1 here, this would have again been the Lagrangian for all the brains added up. And the 2 here is telling you actually that the flux is actually contributing twice. T minus Q phi is the Lagrangian of the brain, and then the flux energy is adjusting a little bit, and that's costing you a little bit of energy because the volume changes a little bit when you change the tension. The fact that you're getting a 2 here shows you that that flux adjustment was competitive with a term in the action. They're the same size. The previous calculation that was not working was one where we kept the bulk response, but we did not keep the brain response, and that was why it was inconsistent. You're throwing away things that were the same size as what you were keeping. So now what happens in the Susie case? If I take this, I specialize it to the case we talked about where there's no flux, we just get the tensions, and this, I told you that in that case the answer was twice the tension, and this is showing you more formally why that's the right answer. And the fluxes don't change that in this case. But in the Susie case, things change in an important way. If you ask what's the condition for stabilizing the scalar field in the Susie case, it looks more complicated. There's a Lagrangian piece which is being stabilized, but then there's another piece which involves the Lagrangian not differentiated. And that looks kind of funny when you first see it. That's the condition that decides what the value of the flat direction is that the system prefers to live at. The way to understand what this is that in this case, the scalar field, you remember, the flat direction was a combination of the metric scaling and the scalar field in the six dimensions. And because it involves the metric, when you dimensionally reduce, you're not in the Einstein frame. If you go to the Einstein frame, the potential that you would have had before, this thing, becomes this. So if I call that combination U, the thing that's in the Einstein frame is the potential, is that times an exponential of 2 e to the 2 phi. If I minimize this, I ask when is V prime equals 0, it's this condition. So the reason you have this extra piece here is because the e to the 2 phi is contributing to the derivative condition. And so this is really telling you something you believed anyway. In this particular case, because the scalar field is partly the metric, you have to go to the Einstein frame before you find a potential that you would minimize. And so that's consistent with what you would have expected. The interesting thing is if you look at the value of the potential at this minimum, it's actually the same as it was in the non-Susie case. It's the Lagrangian, and there's a factor of 2 here, just as before. But because this condition changed, I can trade that factor for this factor. And so the energy density is also writable in this way, and that is the derivative of the Lagrangian. And that was what the general argument said the answer should have been. So that shows you that if you give me any example where the Lagrangian does not depend on the dilaton, phi, this will always be 0, and that's always going to be a solution which is exactly flat. I'm only showing you at the linearized level here, but the general argument I was alluding to before shows you that it's an exact statement at the classical approximation in the extra dimensions. But this resolves the paradox that if you do the stupid calculation, why isn't the exact argument giving you the same answer as the stupid argument? And this shows you that the stupid argument does work if you work it right. So there's three interesting examples of this that are worth thinking through in more detail. One is the reality check. There's one choice. If you ask why was the flat direction lifted, the classical equations in the bulk had a scale invariance. And generically, if you choose the tensions and the flux to depend on the scalar field, what you're doing is you're making the brain Lagrangian break that scale invariance, or that symmetry, whatever it was. And that's why you're lifting the flat direction. The boundary condition at one brain is inconsistent with the boundary condition at the other brain unless you have the zero mode of that scalar field chosen in just the right way. So it's like a Goldberger-Wise mechanism, but in codimension 2 rather than codimension 1. In the scalar, but you can choose the brains to be scale invariant. And this is the choice that would be scale invariant. You choose the tension to be independent of phi, and you choose the flux to be in this particular exponential of phi. In that case, the argument I showed you before gives you this. And this is what you expected on general grounds anyway. If you have a scale invariant solution, it has to be an exponential, because that's the thing that scales the proper way. And the only story is what this constant is. And this constant is some combination of the tension and the flux. It's either zero or it's not. If it's zero, that's a case where you have a flat direction. If it's not, that's a case where you've lifted the flat direction, and that's the Weinberg no-go issue that you have a runaway to phi equals infinity. So that works the way it's supposed to work. The second interesting example is if you chose the tensions to have some minimum at some value and make the value for phi that minimizes the tensions something which is large-ish but not huge, like minus 50 or something like that, then you remember in the supersymmetric case, the radius of the extra dimensions was exponentially related to the scalar field because there was the way I wrote it in the ansatz, there was an exponential of phi in front of the whole metric in the extra dimensions, and that was the flat direction for scale invariants. So you stabilize phi at a place which is minus 50, and then this radius is e to the 50. And so it's very, very easy to get exponentially large directions, extra dimensions in this kind of a context. Very much like the Randall-Sundrum model, you're choosing things in the exponent, and so the missing step in the ADD model was why are the extra dimensions large if you want to solve the hierarchy problem by having extra dimensions that are large. This would be a solution to that. That's very similar to the Randall-Sundrum one. You choose a number, you choose your brains to stabilize this thing at 50, and then for free you've got enormous extra dimensions. But the most interesting one is the one which keeps the curvature small. So if I choose delta t and delta phi to be independent of the dilaton, then it's an exact statement that rho is zero. That's not a scale invariant choice because I had to choose a phi dependence for the flux to be scale invariant. But it happens that scale invariance and this condition of phi independence agree for the leading term. And that's kind of why the magic of the tension being independent of phi was important. It's important that delta phi here is independent of phi because that means that the flux quantization condition, which I should remind you what it is. Maybe I didn't write it down here. This probably is not worth it, but I'm here now, so I'm committed. All right, so the important thing is that because that's independent of phi, this now has a phi dependence. If I had been scale invariant, the phi dependence would have canceled here. But I'm not choosing a scale invariant choice. I'm making the Lagrangian independent of phi. So that means that the way that I'll satisfy the flux, if you ask why does the vacuum energy stay zero as I change the tension, what's happening is that phi in the flat direction is rolling out until it satisfies the flux quantization condition. And once it satisfies the flux quantization condition, this condition is the condition that potential be zero at its minimum. And so the relaxation that's happening is the flat direction, the flux quantization condition is choosing the value that the phi has to have, even though the brain didn't depend on phi at all. So let me just get back to where I was here. All right, so phi adjusts. So this is the remarkable thing. And what's particularly remarkable is that you immediately want to ask, what do loops do to this? And in particular, in this kind of a context, you're thinking that the standard model particles that I started off with, the electron and the W boson, those are all localized on the brain. Those are the least, that's a very non-supersymmetric place. In a world like this, where the Kaluza-Klein scale was as small as the cosmological constant problem, the scale on the brain and the gravity scale in the extra dimensions can't be much lower than 10 TeV, or can't be. It has to be not too far from the weak scale. So whatever we're living on, if we're living on a brain, it's not a supersymmetric one. And so you should be, the particles that we see are not being protected by supersymmetry. So you have to ask, loops of them, why don't they screw up, do they screw up the argument I just gave you? And what's remarkable is the criterion that I gave you for having the energy be zero is one which is absolutely stable against loops on the brain. The absence of a coupling to a bulk field is something, if you don't have one to start with, you will not grow one by doing just brain loops. The only way that you can change the phi dependence of the brain action is to involve bulk loops, because the metric certainly couples to the brain, and the metric couples to the dilaton, so the metric can give you a coupling to the dilaton if you didn't start with one. But you have to have a bulk loop to get any dependence of phi in the brain action. So this kind of a choice is something which loves to be stable against the loops on the brain. That's the first observation. The second observation is that bulk loops are actually, the great thing about bulk loops is that the exponential of phi, you remember, was related to 1 over the radius. If you have very large extra dimensions, then e to the phi is a very small thing. Now, the reason that's special is that in the supergravity, not in the non-supersymmetric case, but in the supergravity, the loop counting parameter is e to the phi, e to the 2 phi, actually. So every loop costs you a factor of e to the phi, e to the 2 phi, and that costs you a factor of 1 over r to the fourth. And so the cosmological constant problem in the bulk is not it's a one-loop problem, and then you're done, because the couplings there are so incredibly small. And they're small because they're volume suppressed, and that's kind of the general magic that happens when the gravity scale is low. R is the radius of the extra dimensions, the sphere. The physical radius, the proper radius. So we're kind of in the process of kind of fleshing this out. But essentially what happens is that if you actually, you can check this by, if you explicitly do a loop in the extra dimensions for an arbitrary field, for a very massive field, and the massive ones are the dangerous ones, of course, because that's the ultraviolet sensitivity you're worried about, you generically get a contribution to the potential which is too large. It goes like 1 over r squared rather than 1 over r to the fourth. 1 over r to the fourth is what the observed cosmological constant would be if we had the extra dimensions at a micron, say. But if you sum those contributions, those loop contributions, over a supermultiplet in 6 dimensions, then they cancel. The leading term cancels, and you're left with something this size. And so what's happening is that the very high, very short wavelength things that are far from the brain, they don't know that supersymmetry broke. And so that you have the benefits of 6-dimensional supergravity for the ultraviolet physics in the bulk protecting you. When you get near the brain, then you do see that supersymmetry broke because the brain is breaking it. But then the corrections are corrections to things that were order of the weak scale, because that's the tensions were order of the weak scale. And because the corrections will be proportional to e to the 2 phi, the corrections you get to the back reaction are order e to the 2 phi, and that's the right size too. That's also the Kluge-Klein scale to the fourth power. So the things that were dangerous in the bulk are saved by supersymmetry. The things that are dangerous near the brain are saved by supersymmetry in the sense that it's the bulks that are, supersymmetry makes this the loop counting parameter. And the brain itself is safe because the criterion you were looking for was absence of a coupling to the bulk fields, and that's something which is stable under brain loops. So I'm probably out of time now, right? So my main message was that there's a, I've been on a soapbox about how extra dimensions can preserve, make energies smaller than they would have otherwise have been. There's a parametric suppression in the vacuum energy in these extra dimensional models. But what was missing was a concrete example where you could just do a stupid calculation and follow everything. And I'm claiming this is the concrete example. And the obstruction that people had hit before was that if you did the stupid thing and you neglected the flux that was localized on the brain, or that could be localized in the brain, then you're not exploring all of field space, and in particular, you're missing the low energy ones. And the issue of the cosmological constant is not to show that all solutions have low energy, it's to show that there exist solutions that have low energy. And that if you make a low energy choice, the choices that you make are stable under renormalization of the integrating out heavy fields. And so what's remarkable with this system is that it has those ingredients, and it's incredible that it does. The last part was just about time-dependent solutions.
But you do have solutions that have large curvature.
There are other solutions that have large curvature, right.
So you're not exploiting
it. Right, and the simplest way to get them is to make t a function of phi. If you make t a generic function of phi, then what will happen is that you'll live at rho will have some generic value, which is not small. So the two nice things that I was showing you, getting a naturally exponentially large size of extra dimensions and getting a zero curvature, I can't do them both together yet. Because if I chose a generic T that had a minimum, I would have had a large radius, but I wouldn't have had a particularly small curvature. So that's something which I think that you can do better than what I've shown you. But the choices that you make in the curvature case are technically natural once you made them.
So once you get into one loop, then you know what the size of the curvature will be. Then that will give you the constraint on the size of the extra dimension. Then now you're taking mode, and then you can work out all the.
Yeah,
when you say micron, that's the ballpark figure you expect. But in principle, you could exactly.
In principle, you could if you actually take a specific geometry and calculate the Casimir energy, that'll tell you exactly the size.
Yeah, it's a one loop computation. You're saying.
Yeah, you could follow all the 2 pi's, and it should really be a very precise statement.
And micron means KK modes that are at the electron week, or what do you know?
No, they're like 10 to the minus 2. They're at the cosmological constant scale, basically 10 to the minus 2 electron volts.
So these are KK modes of graviton at the
so it's like it's like an ADD kind of it's ADD was metric only in the extra dimensions because they didn't want supersymmetry because they wanted to solve the hierarchy problem with the extra dimensions. Mm-hmm. This is like a supersymmetric extra dimensions, but the extra dimensions are as large as they can be, and the numerology is that as large as they can be is also the size that makes the Kluge-Klein scale the cosmological constant, and it's also the size that makes the gravity scale in the ballpark of the weak scale if there's only 2 of them. So that's what makes the 6 special is that.
Can I understand it from 4D effective theory? Like, if I go back to your initial motivation,
yeah.
You have the page. Can you go back to that page?
Yes.
Do you have the?
Can I come back to the very end? Let me just do these last slides because
sure.
You're asking Nima's question, and so it's a great, which is essentially what's the 4-dimensional point of view,
yep.
Right? And so there's a take on that, and there's an, and Nima has a reply to the take, which I think I have a reply to, so, but I'd like to, it'll take a little bit longer, so if I just kind of flash through this. The last slides I'm going to show you is a time-dependent solution, and the reason, one motivation for it would be that if you bought the rest of it, you might say, well, I like inflation, and then if you're giving me gravity scales at low scale, I've given up all the nice things about inflation at the gut scale. And one of the things that's going to, you'll see in this, is a time-dependent solution which accelerates in the four dimensions, the extra dimensions grow, and so the gravity scale is changing as inflation happens. And so so part of the motivation for this would be that you can have your cake and eat it too if you want to, but it's the first step in the directions of trying to make us.
You can still have the measure problem.
That's right. If you want it, it's there. It's there for you, exactly. So let me just, you don't need the motivation. It's the same bulk system. I'm going to choose the supersymmetric one. I'm going to make physics in the brain. I'm going to add a scalar field on the one brain. I'm going to choose its potential in a very specific way. I'm imagining it's a series in e to the chi, which is a new field. I'm going to imagine that dominates, so for some reason this is small. I'm going to give you a solution where this thing shrinks, and eventually this one will become important. But I'm choosing these things, this exponential here and this exponential here, because I have an exact solution, which is power laws, which is not a big surprise. If a scale invariant problem typically has power law solutions for time, and I gave you a scale invariant problem, so I'm going to give you the power law solution in time. And I'm just dreaming up a brain action which will match onto that, is essentially what I'm doing here. So here's the solution. It's a time-dependent up front. There's a time dependence in front of the internal directions. The dilaton is doing another time-dependent thing. To interpret the cosmology, I need to not only go to FRW time, but I need to go to the Einstein frame first, because the scalar field is also a function of time. And so I'm not going to make just this the dt squared here constant. I have to first go to the Einstein frame and then make it constant. And that is this change of variables.
Mn are the big dimensions?
These are the four dimensions that on the brain, and these are the ones, the two that are transverse to the brain. And C is a parameter that's arbitrary, you get to choose. And there's a set of equations that tell you how the radial parts, the spatial parts of the metric are related to one another, which I'm not solving for you, but I'm just really focusing on the time dependence right now. But you need to follow those if you're trying to match onto the brains, because that's where all the derivatives are that you're going to match to the brains. So in terms of this time, if C is minus 2, it turns out that this is an exponential, the scale factor here is an exponential in time, and this is the Spitzer space solution, which actually had been written down, you know, 5 years ago by these people. And there's no Go theorems, which should say it's impossible, which came later, actually. And this evades them through one of their loopholes, which I can tell you about if you ask about it later on. If C is not minus 2, then you get different kinds of expansion, all of which are power laws. But you're not going to be surprised if I give you the Sitter space, I can find something near the Sitter space, and that'll be accelerating. It turns out that C less than minus 2 is the accelerating branch. The scale factor goes like T to a power, and the power is this, and this is bigger than 1 if C is less than minus 2. But it's always true, in this case, that the radius goes like the square root of time of the extra dimensions, whereas in this other case, the radius was a constant. So in this one case, the radius goes like the fact that the radius is like, you can kind of see it here, that if C is minus 2, then the 2 and the C come together to make this in time independent. But otherwise, it's always true that in FRW time, the radius is going like the square root of time.
It looks kind of singular there.
At t equals 0 is a funny place, yeah, so don't take it too seriously there. Yeah. Now, the main message is that if you've got an accelerating solution where the scale factor is growing faster than linear in time, the extra dimensions are always growing, but they're always growing parametrically slow compared to the large four dimensions are. And you can match this onto that action I gave you, and the parameters C and H naught are related to these choices you're making in the potential in this way. And so you can imagine turning off inflation by having the parameters are such that this thing is shrinking like a power. As time gets larger, this goes down, and eventually I can leave the scaling solution. I can't tell you where I go, but I do know that it won't be the solution anymore. And so the hope would be that that's ending inflation. All right, so the bottom line is that there's three things I'm trying to sell you here. One of them is naturalist problems in extra dimensions have profited by the gravity scale being low, and by examining in detail how brains back react onto their geometry. And the ADD and the Randall-Sundrum scenarios are kind of the examples of those two things. But the back reaction problem has only been explored in codimension 1 in any detail, and it's almost certainly true that codimension 2 and higher has got a lot of interesting things in it, because codimension 1 is very unlikely to be a reliable indicator of what generically happens. So part of the story I've told you is a solution to this back reaction problem in the codimension 2 case. Second part of the story was that back reaction, one of the nice things I think it's doing is it's parametrically suppressing the effective curvature on the four dimensions in a brain world like this relative to what you would have naively thought in four dimensions. And I'm going to come back to your question about how the four-dimensional person sees it. The third thing I told you about was but supersymmetry was an important part of that. If you're going to use this, extra dimensions didn't suffice. If you didn't have supersymmetry, you could say, well, why don't I have a cosmological constant in the extra dimensions? And that's a good question. Supersymmetry can forbid that. In six dimensions and higher, it automatically does forbid it. So that's where supersymmetry is useful. But here, supersymmetry is broken at a very low scale. It's broken at the Klutz-Klein scale. So this is the counterexample to the statement that weak-scale supersymmetry requires the MSSM. This is an example of a theory which has very low-scale supersymmetry breaking, but you would not expect to find MSSM particles, and so that's exactly what the LHC is now finding. So they're, check one off. They're doing very well. The last thing I would try to tell you was that you can actually go beyond the effective descriptions of cosmology and write down explicit time-dependent solutions. Six dimensions is nice because it's complicated enough that it has many features that 10 dimensions has, but it's simple enough that you can actually solve things. And so you can write down these explicitly time-evolving geometries where you can follow the extra dimensions and see them do interesting things as, say, inflation happens. And that could be very useful in understanding the late time universe and the phenomenology of inflation. So thank you for your time. Can I ask to do this question first and then come back here, or is it?
I might sleep.
That'd be worth seeing anyway. So the question was, what's the four-dimensional perspective? And if there is one, what do you need the extra dimensions for? Is it kind of unstated in that, but that's more or less the thing. So the picture is, you can kind of draw scales, right? So there's 10 dimensions, or maybe it's better doing the board over here. So if you...
I think we can do it today.
People all mess.
Okay.
So if you take, so let's say this is the TeV scale. Here's the 10 to the minus 2 electron volt scale. Or so here's the electron mass, da-da-da. And this is also in this picture the Klutz-Klein scale. So the world, the gravitational world above this point is six-dimensional, but particle physics is still four-dimensional here, because you're imagining that in this six-dimensional picture, particle physics is stuck on this brain, but gravity isn't. So that's kind of part of why you're making the electron not ruin electromagnetism, even though you're changing how it gravitates. So in the four-dimensional story, one part of the superficial answer is that in the effective theory where you're four-dimensional, there is no cosmological constant problem, because the biggest scale in your problem is the cosmological constant. So you're not surprised to find that if your cutoff, if your biggest mass was 10 to the minus 2 electron volts, you wouldn't be surprised to find a cosmological constant that is that large. Here, your gravitational response has to be done in six dimensions. And so there's not an intrinsically four-dimensional description. But this is where NEMA has the comeback. And NEMA's comeback was, that's all very fine, but if I have a cosmological constant, I can't extract energy from that. It's something which I can make the universe inflate, but the Hubble scale I would get from that is actually lower than the cosmological constant. So I can have a cosmological constant in an effective theory where the scale of the cosmological constant is actually large compared to what I thought the cutoff of the effective theory was. So he says, well, give me your theory. I'm going to now adiabatically dial up the vacuum energy to be very, very, very large, and I'll make it up here somewhere. But I've done it very, very slowly, so I never excited any Klutz-Klein modes. And then I sit there, and I should see, the universe wants to now have a de Sitter expansion, but the Hubble scale is still down here, so I don't have a problem from the effective theory breaking down. Now you have to tell me the answer in four dimensions, because I could phrase that problem in four dimensions, and so you should be able to solve it there. And the thing the assumption he makes, which is wrong in these theories, is because of the scale invariance, there was a flat direction. The thing that you dial up, you can never dial up a constant. The best you can do is you can dial up a constant times e to the phi. This flat direction is always, the things you would dial are always dialing the phi dependence. So you can make this thing large, but as soon as you make this thing large, you've not only made the potential high, you've made the slope high. And so then you can't describe a constant, this constant can't be bigger than the cutoff without actually seeing that you're in higher dimensions, because you can extract enough energy from the roll to see that you're living you're exciting the Klutz-Klein modes, and so you can't analyze that in four dimensions. And that underlines the fact that there's something I didn't emphasize, is that the dark energy here is not a cosmological constant. It's a quintessence model. It's the Albrecht's Ortis model. And it's, a million years ago, Andy said, give me a theory where you've got logarithms in your potential, and I'll give you a good quintessence model. and this is the theory that we didn't know we were looking for, but it's essentially this is what you get, is that you get exponentials with powers of phi involved as well. So that, and the thing is that you're, the same thing that makes the potential energy small also makes the slope small. And so that you might, normally for a quintessence model, you would say that there's two tuning issues. You've made the vacuum energy small, and you've made the quintessence field have a mass at the Hubble scale. And both those things are being dealt with by the extra dimensions in this case. That if you, and the way you understand that in low energies is that the cutoff, or the ultraviolet scale in the four-dimensional theory is essentially the cosmological constant scale. And so a generic correction to the mass in that theory would have been, for a quintessence theory, would have been something like this, given that it couples gravitationally. And that's the Hubble scale, basically. And in the theory above that scale, if you're in six dimensions, then the same physics that's making the potential small, the scale invariance essentially in the supersymmetry, is protecting the mass as well. It's the same issue in the, and if you follow it as a function of the radius, the potential, the dangerous term from the point of view of the cosmological constant is also the one that's dangerous from the point of view of the mass.
So what is the mass that you?
It's essentially the Hubble scale. So this is going to want to be a quintessence model, an honest to God quintessence model, and it's the existence of that scalar that is the thing that's making Neeman's argument fail. You really have a light degree of freedom that you have to follow. And you're raising a potential. You're not raising the potential as a constant. The things that you do when you change the things in the extra dimensions is you tend to lift the flat direction. You don't raise it homogeneously as a constant. It's actually difficult to raise it. This is essentially the volume of the extra dimensions. It's hard to do something which is not depending at all on the volume of the extra dimensions. I was heading somewhere with that. It was really good too, and I forgot what it is now.
Sorry.
So why don't I ask your question? Right?
So, when I see models like this or any others, I start asking, so how do they get there? How do they get to that solution? And we, you know, in some sense, people hope inflation explains it, but that's, I'd like to see it.
I think I would too, but that's so far down the road of a list of things on the list that. So I think that this inflationary solution is a step in that direction, because the first thing you want to know is how generic is it, right? Is there anything that would make this kind of thing want to happen? And I have no idea what because so few of the time-dependent solutions are known. But my goals are much less ambitious, because I would like to just understand late things in terms of slightly earlier things. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be happy just if I could start off with this kind of a choice, if I could then account for, say, the cosmology at that, you know, at the weak scale, even that's already hard in these models. And that's
but I think okay, so that's cool. But another piece of that is the explanation could be because you're in a particular part of this giant phase space of the brains.
Yeah.
What have you? And so you could be passing on tuning problems that way.
To the extent I am, I'm not passing on. That's why I kind of wanted to be very careful about saying technical naturalness. They won't be technical naturalness problems. You might have thought that even if I didn't solve the technical naturalness issue, maybe, you know, some argument, a landscapey kind of argument, might have preferred these solutions for some other reason. And I have no idea if that's true either. And I'm taking the point of view that if you had the choice between those two kinds of explanations, you'd prefer the technically natural one, because it's a mechanism you can stick in the landscape anyway if you like the landscape. But it's something where. You know, of all the people I've talked to, there's a landscape, and then there's the Bay Area landscape. Right? There's the landscape, which is just there's lots of solutions probably to string theory, and then there's the hardcore anthropic overlay that you get in Stanford.
Where you cosmology?
Yeah, well, but also where the anthropic arguments are really playing an important role as to how you make predictions. And every time I talk to somebody who pushes the Bay Area landscape, they would agree that if you had a technically natural solution, that would be nicer. And they wouldn't want to stop looking for it just because they're using anthropic arguments. But it's almost like the anthropic argument is like the argument of last resort at some point. And so if you have an alternative, that's
the best. So I'm not defending.
I tried to thrust you in the anthropic
realm. Yeah. That was the smartest ever maneuver.
But those issues are deep issues, and I really don't have anything to say about them because I don't really understand that.
I think you could answer. So inflation was just gesture
that
direction.
Yeah.
Stated in another way, is there some observable that counts the number of extra dimensions in one of these brains? I mean, is there something you would look at to say that is it one or two or three?
the simplest thing I can think of is if you is test the Newton's law, because they're how, it,
yeah,
how
yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
inverse square law will go to inverse fourth law. And it's often they often do these plots.
And so yeah, sorry, is this
so the bounds now are like 45 microns. So I think that's the smoking gun, because there's no way that this can happen. I didn't talk about the observational things here, but there's the LHC has to see gravity physics. You know, that's one thing that has to happen. The dark energy is quintessence. There's another thing that has to happen. And all the things that go with that. There's, you know, it happens that the scalar you get is a Brans-Dickey-like scalar. So it's
kind of what I was wondering. Is there something at the LHC where generically if it's one extra dimension, if there's n extra dimensions and some cross-section has to fall off as
the energy dependence, yeah, definitely, yeah. No, the energy dependence is a dimension dependent power.
In a model independent way, or in a model dependent way? Are there things where can you always twiddle the model together with an extra number of extra dimensions to?
I think it's like the usual thing that the generic statement is model independent in the sense that for instance, what's known really well is for gravity. So if you're using gravity, then the coupling is essentially proportional to some inverse power of some scale. And on dimensional grounds, you get that energy, whatever the energy you need, divided by that scale. And there's just a lot more phase space the more dimensions you have. And so that's where the energy is coming from. And so but what's also true is that if you're six dimensions is special in the sense that if you ask, are there couplings that are not suppressed by a mass scale that have dimensionless couplings, the only dimensions in which you can have those is in six dimensions. Because, for instance, if you have a Higgs on the brain and then an extra dimensional scalar, that's got a dimensionless coefficient. But in five dimensions, you don't have that because the fields are all fractionally dimensions. And in higher dimensions, you don't have it because the fields have too high dimension to have a dimensionless coefficient with a standard model thing. So in six dimensions, there can be couplings which are only logarithmically sensitive to the scale, so they have a different energy dependence. And so in that case, for those specific particles, you can have different cross-sections. But that's almost completely unexplored. There's three couplings that are like that. And the only example that was explored, we explored, like, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. And so there, I think there are exceptions.
The example that you guys explored is when you said Higgs.
The Higgs, yeah. But there's another one which is like the gauge field scalar on the brain mixing, and there's also a Kalb-Ramon field and then a gauge field on the brain mixing. So you can make a list, but
you didn't include Higgs field two scalars because the extra dimensional scalars don't have any SP2.
That's one reason, but you know, I could probably make a model where they are. But it's just dimensionally. This is phi is a mass squared, and h is a mass. So this is a mass to the fifth. So I'd have a 1/1 mass in front on the brain. So to get something dimensionless, you need something like h squared phi, because then that's 2 and 2 is 4. So there's the story about Brans-Dickey scalars is really interesting from the point of view of pulsars, because this the scalar that you get comes to you as a Brans-Dickey scalar, which is on the one hand bad news. In the sense that the Brans-Dickey parameter is too big it's ruled out already nominally. On the other hand, it's good news in the sense that the bounds that are dangerous are these ones for the equivalence principle, which are automatically taken care of in the Brans-Dickey kind of coupling. And the reason that the theory is not dead because of the Brans-Dickey coupling being large is that that's the leading order calculation is it's large. But what happens is that the Brans-Dickey coupling turns out to be a function of the field phi. So it starts off as being a constant, which is too large, but then it's got, b times phi and so on, and that means that the coupling depends on where, in principle, can depend on where you are and when you look, because phi is a function of in cosmology, it'd be a function of time, say. So, in practice, you know, all you know is that now, in the solar system, this is small. It doesn't say that it was always small or that it's not small everywhere. So it's really interesting to look at things like pulsars because those are looking at places that are not here. And so there's a whole story about what the bounds are on fields like this, but it's and there are constraints that come from that, from those kind of observables, but they're not fatal yet. If this kills it, I'd actually be happy because that means you bought the cosmological constant argument. but it's certainly a serious issue, and I think that there's phenomenology there that you need to worry about.
Can I ask how do you get the cosmological constant? So one loop, it's a gravity problem. I mean, it's the bulk field. So it's a gravity loops, right? But you know how to do this?
If you have
a theory for it, you'd be gravity. You just were normalizing.
It's just like a vacuum energy. So you, if you there's for simple spaces, you can just do it explicitly. So if it's a sphere or a torus, then you can do it explicitly. A torus is really simple because in that case, the only divergence you get is one for the cosmological constant in the extra dimensions. And so in that case, if you have a supersymmetric theory, that just happens to be zero anyway because the bosons cancel the fermions. And then the subdominant stuff that breaks supersymmetry, as you might do with boundary conditions, is actually finite. For a sphere, what happens is that you do get divergences, and they would, it's the usual quantum gravity story that they were normalizing. You know, for instance, if you curvature cube terms in the extra dimensions, integrated over the extra dimensions, go like 1 over r to the 4. And this can have a dimensionless coefficient, so it can have a logarithmic divergence, if you like. And so if you actually calculate the Casimir energy in a sphere in 6 dimensions, you find that it has a, it depends, it's 1 over r to the 4th, you know, a plus b log r. And it's that log is there because there's a log divergence which, when you normalize, has a normalization point. no worries, I know we're running really late. So there's a residual logarithm that you inherit from the fact that you actually had a log divergence that was being normalized by a coefficient.
And so you can't find the finite pieces, and all the KK modes, you can add them in and just do a finite.
Well, that's the hard way to do it. So you can do it one KK mode at a time.
Or you work directly in 60.
It's better to work in 60 because what happens is that this argument is relying heavily on general covariance in the extra dimensions to organize your counter terms. And KK mode by KK mode, that's really hard to see happening. So people have made statements in the literature that if you did it on a torus, you'd get all these kind of divergences. Whereas on a torus, it's actually very simple because all the counter terms are vanishing because the curvature is all zero. And so there's very few divergences on a torus, and that's completely obscure if you do it mode by mode.
Okay.